from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Eric Westervelt sitting in for Mina Kim. Last night, President Donald Trump ordered the first direct U.S. military action against Syrian government forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad in response to an apparent chemical weapons attack that killed more than 80 civilians, including many children.
No child of God should ever suffer such horror. Tonight I ordered a targeted military strike on the airfield in Syria from where the chemical attack was launched.
We'll bring you the latest on the airstrikes against Syria and analysis of the military, diplomatic, and political fallout. That's coming up on Forum. Join us after the news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Eric Westervelt sitting in for Mina Kim. In this hour's Forum program, America, Syria, and the Middle East chessboard, everything just got a little more complicated. In response to an apparent chemical weapons attack by the Syrian government, President Trump last night ordered a Tomahawk missile strike on a Syrian airfield. U.S. warships fired nearly 60 missiles on a Syrian military site that apparently played a key role in the recent sarin nerve gas attack that killed more than 80 civilians. Targets included Syrian air defenses, aircraft, hangars, and fuel depots. President Trump spoke last night from his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida.
Tonight I call on all civilized nations to join us in seeking to end the slaughter and bloodshed in Syria, and also to end terrorism of all kinds and all types.
This is the first major U.S. strike against the regime of Syrian President Assad. The Russian military, which is backing Assad, was warned as part of a deconfliction protocol. The White House says Russia's President Vladimir Putin was not informed about the strike ahead of time. This morning, a spokesman for Putin said the missile strike, quote, deals a significant blow to relations between Russia and America, which are already in a poor state. And Russia has now suspended a joint air safety agreement. It's not clear the missile strike did any substantial damage to the Syrian military or its aircraft. But the attack did just pull America deeper into the complex and ugly Syrian civil war, a conflict now more than 6 years old. America and Syria, in this hour's Forum, the military, diplomatic, and political fallout. Joining us now from London is BBC editor of Arab Affairs, Sebastian Usher. Sebastian, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Sebastian, Usher, dramatic images of Tomahawk missiles leaving U.S. warships. But what do we know, if anything, about what kind of military damage the strike had? Does it change anything on the ground militarily in Syria?
In the immediate aftermath of the attack, no, I don't think it does. I don't think it was intended to particularly. It was a message, a deterrent, essentially to say, you know, you've crossed this line. President Trump making clear that unlike his predecessor, Barack Obama, he would respect the fact that line had been crossed and take some action, but very limited. And they're emphasizing how precise. I mean, these were massive attacks, nearly 60 cruise missiles. From the American reports, the suggestion is that they were trying to minimize any loss of life, that the targets were the infrastructure of this particular airbase. What we've heard from the Syrian and the Russian side, and we've had one or two eyewitnesses in the area, is that there may have been civilian casualties. The Syrians have said at least nine, of which some were children. We've also heard that at least six of the military personnel at the base were killed. But there does seem to be an effort to have avoided any high level of casualties, even amongst the military personnel, and of course, especially amongst the Russians. I think there was a very big effort to ensure that no Russians were wounded or killed in this attack.
Sebastian Usher, let's talk a little bit more about that message. I mean, it looks like a punitive and fairly limited strike intended to send a message to deter the Syrian government from using chemical weapons. Given Assad's history, do you think it will deter him?
Well, there is a question mark over why the Syrian government at this moment used chemical weapons on this scale. There have been a number of reports. I was getting a report just a few days before this from Hama, there'd been an attack on a hospital, which an eyewitness was telling me was a chemical gas attack, but that was a much smaller one, and sarin did not appear to be involved. So since the major attack back in 2013 on Ghouta, the Damascus suburb, which brought President Obama to the brink of a much bigger offensive against President Assad, which in the end, of course, he didn't do. There have been attacks, but back in 2013, President Assad was on the ropes. He was in big trouble. His military forces were stretched. He didn't have the support on the ground from the Russians and in the air. Since then, the last year and a half has seen a huge turnaround. The momentum is very much seen, not so much President Assad obviously can win back the whole of Syria, can conclusively win the war, but that he has done enough with the Russian, Iranian and other support to ensure that the rebels can't, and that he has control of what matters most in Syria, the main urban centres. So big question mark over why the chemical attack happened in the first place. So from that, I suppose one can say that if it is true, as most indications suggest, that President Assad, the Syrians, were the ones who carried out the attack, it would seem very unlikely, one would think, that they would be doing it again unless they want to challenge President Trump further and essentially say, look, OK, so you made your statement. You didn't want to go too far. We've done this. So what are you going to do afterwards? I would say that the feeling with President Assad and his advisors, perhaps even the Russians, was that the noises the Trump administration had made up until the chemical gas attack and towards Russia as well seemed much more conciliatory than what we've been hearing under President Obama. That has now changed. So I think as a deterrent, it may well do its job.
It does seem puzzling. If you're winning a war, why would you use banned chemical weapons? Is there any kind of grim logic to why Assad would do this? Is it a kind of, I'm winning so I can? What are your thoughts on that?
There's partly that. There's also, I mean, throughout the war, the Syrian government side has made clear when it can, and it has done so pretty much with impunity, to the areas that are defying them, that they will do anything to destroy those areas and reduce them by attrition. We've seen that in eastern Aleppo. We've seen that in the cities, Homs, Hama, which have come under the control of the Syrian government. That's only been after huge bombardments of, great loss of life, not just amongst rebels, but amongst, children. We were hearing from President Trump about the beautiful babies. I mean, rebels and opposition voices inside the country have kind of raised the question of, this has been going on. It's, whether it's chemical gas attack or it's a barrel bomb, it's the same thing in the end. And it's children, families who've been destroyed. And they have called for much greater action. Of course, they've welcomed this. But if it's just a one-off, they don't really see that it does very much for them. So, as I say, from the Assad side, it's essentially a very grim, powerful message which perhaps they thought they could once again carry out with impunity in Idlib, this province where so many of the rebels have taken refuge, to say, you are not safe there. We will use all the power we have to destroy you. So, know that your cause is finished. You can't hold out here forever. That may have been the thinking behind it.
We're talking about America and the Syrian civil war in this hour's forum. I'm Eric Westervelt. The military, the diplomatic, and the political fallout. We're with BBC editor of Arab Affairs, Sebastian Usher. And Sebastian, tell us a little bit, how is the Middle East reacting to the strike this morning? We've had some hours since the attack.
Well, the closest supporter to President Assad in the Middle East, Iran, has condemned the attack, but there haven't been any major statements from the president or the supreme leader. The foreign minister, Javad Zarif, has tweeted saying that essentially this is a sign of military force from the Americans again over bogus claims of chemical weapons use, as happened in Iraq. So kind of dismissing it on that level. But what you'll find in much of the rest of the Middle East is the governments, at least, are happy about this. The Saudis, the other Gulf countries, even Jordan, have felt that America had become almost an irrelevance in the past two or three years in the Syrian conflict as Russia dominated the battlefield because of its military involvement. And they feel from this that that strengthened Iran, which, as I say, is the other major backer for President Assad. So they're happy to see this military re-engagement by the US. So there's been support from that level, as I say, from the Saudis, from other Gulf countries. So, and I mean, that was to be expected. Whether they would follow that if America were to go much further and to engage, which I think is very, very unlikely, but on the level, anything near the level of what has happened in Iraq, that mood could obviously change if there was large loss of civilian lives. We're seeing that to some extent in the offensive in Mosul, where, of course, there's been great concern over civilian loss of life there in the battle to drive ISIL out of its last big stronghold in Iraq. And the US-led coalition, US planes, have been accused of carrying out airstrikes which have killed hundreds of people. There have been some voices in the Middle East, not government voices, not official voices, but saying, you know, this is timed by the Trump administration to divert attention from that.
Sebastian Usher in London, briefly, because I know you have to run. Tell us the UK reaction this morning.
Well, the UK reaction has been, as you'd expect, full support for what President Trump has done, but with caution, a sense that still it's a political situation that matters most. I think what's interesting is we've had from the UK, we've had from the US, we've had from many other US allies and Turkey and other countries in the region which have backed the rebels, they for years demanded that President Assad must go. We were seeing a change in that recently, and primarily from the US. But that may now go back to a demand that President Assad can have no place in any transition in Syria. That's a whole other level, of course, about peace talks that have so far gone nowhere. But we may see a hardening of that line again. And I mean, the big question will be, does this only apply to chemical gas attacks, or are we expecting to see when the next atrocity is carried out not by chemical gas, but by barrel bombs or those sorts of attacks, and dozens of civilians are killed, and those pictures are shown on screen. Will the US react again?
Sebastian Usher in London. He's the BBC's Arab Affairs editor. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We want to hear from you about the latest from Syria. Do you think the attack was a vital US national security interest? Does this risk pulling America deeper into the Syrian civil war? What do you think? Call us at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Join the conversation on Forum this morning. We're joined now by Marcus Weisgerber. He's global business editor of Defense One. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Thanasis Kambanis. He's a fellow at the Century Foundation, writer and journalist, and author of Once Upon a Revolution, about the Egyptian Revolution and the Arab Spring. Thanasis, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Eric.
Thanasis, to you first, the reaction in the Arab world this morning. This is a complicated fight. ISIS, rebels, the Syrian government, Russia and Iran on one side, the U.S. now taking a firm stand with airstrikes. Talk about the reaction from where you are in Beirut.
Well, so, of course, it depends on how you feel about the Syrian uprising, how you react. All the folks who have been sympathizing with the revolt from the beginning and frustrated by American inaction are applauding. We see Lebanese political officials. We see lots of Syrian activists and exiles who are basically, there's an emotional relief. There's like a great sigh of, at last, America's doing something. Some people have immediately ratcheted up very unrealistic expectations that somehow this is going to lead to an outright full U.S. military intervention on behalf of the uprising, which I don't think is on the table. And others just see this as a welcome balancing to a sort of unhinged and unchallenged Iranian and Russian and Damascus hegemony. On the other side, we've seen, as you were hearing from your first guest, the irritation from Iran and from other pro-Syrian regime parties. And, you know, one of the things that I think is underlying all this is an anxiety that America is going to start throwing its weight around again. And one of the th- think one sort of welcome bubble burstings, in my view, is we've had many years of a shared false assumption that America no longer matters in the region. And, you know, although America can't control everything in the region, America really does have a lot of influence. And now people, especially players like Damascus and Iran and Russia that have gotten accustomed to not having to worry about America's role are going to have to worry about it again.
We're getting lots of questions. Gabriel tweets, can your guest comment on the similarities and differences between the U.S. bombing Syria versus the escalation before the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003? Then asks, this feels like more like a potential one-off to send a message as opposed to the beginning of a larger escalation. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the Trump administration has signaled that regime change is back on the table, although they haven't fully reversed the policy. But Tillerson's comments a few days ago where he said Bashar al-Assad can't be part of a Syria's future, I think, carry that implication. I doubt that Trump is going to want to have a big invasion of Syria. But I also think that what his motives clearly are in part to reestablish American deterrent power, right, and to make clear again that America's red lines mean something, and that probably is going to require more than the strike that happened this week. I'd love to say I trusted his judgment, but I don't. To accomplish that with minimal blowback, you would need a couple of strong symbolic hits by the United States that were at the same time limited the same way that this one was.
Interesting. Let's go now to Marcus Weisgerber. He's global business editor of Defense One. Republican Senator John McCain praised the strike and called President Trump to do more, to, quote, take out Assad's Air Force completely out of the fight. Give us a sense. What else are you hearing in terms of Republican support and Democratic opposition to this action?
Well, Eric, I was at the Pentagon last night as all this unfolded. In the afternoon, we kind of got a wink and a nod, if you will, that something was going to happen. And there's kind of been a buzz around the building all day, people kind of scrambling in and out of meetings behind closed doors. What you've seen so far is you've seen support even among Democrats for these. Chuck Schumer released a statement last night. Excessively praising this, but saying it was necessary due to this due to the chemical attack. Mm-hmm. One thing you brought up earlier about the differences between going into Iraq in 2003 and this right now is the U.S. had a massive buildup of troops before that down in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and also down in the Emirates. We're not seeing anything like that now. The U.S. military does have a strong presence there, but you're not seeing a massing of, say, ground forces that would be airdropped in. These were two ships out in the Med, no people on the ground anywhere near this base as far as we know, and other than the routine airstrikes that have been going on now for nearly 3 years against ISIS in Syria.
We're talking about America and Syria. We're joined by Marcus Weisgerber, global business editor at Defense One, and Thanasis Kambanis, a fellow at the Century Foundation. A lot of calls coming in this morning. Let's take one. We're going to go to Carl in San Francisco. Carl, you're on the air. Welcome to Forum.
Thank you. Hi.
What's your question?
Well, I was curious how much maybe someone listening might know. How much do 59 Tomahawk missiles cost?
Well, Marcus, you want to try to grab that and talk a little bit about the technology used to strike this base and tell us why this base was picked and how important it is to the Syrian military.
Sure. So first off, the base was picked because it's believed that this is the base where the Syrians launched the chemical weapon strike attack on Tuesday. The Pentagon last night provided us with what they say our radar or some a track of the aircraft that were used to carry out these strikes by the Syrians. Now, they wouldn't say how they obtained these tracks, likely through some sort of radar or satellites. We do know that there's U.S. intelligence aircraft all over the region, and say a radar plane flying over the Med would probably be able to see into Syria. Now, the Tomahawk costs around $1 million a pop. So you're looking at about $60 million just in the weapon alone. It can fly more than 1,000 miles on a pre-programmed route. So what we hear happened was these 59 missiles were launched from the ships, and they all hit very quickly within a 10-minute window of each other. So, you know, you have your 1,000-pound warheads on these. They all loiter, if you will, wait for all the other ones to launch, and they all go in at the same time. So you're essentially having 60,000 pounds of bombs all landing at once. The other thing is the Tomahawk. The military is supposed to actually stop buying the Tomahawk this year. Is supposed to be the last year of its production. They've been looking at more advanced versions of this weapon. It does not – it flies low, so it's difficult – and fast, so it's difficult to see. But it's not stealthy, and it could be detected by radar. So the military has just started the process of developing a new version of the Tomahawk. However, they still have a large, large stockpile, 3,000-plus Tomahawks in the U.S. arsenal.
Thanasis Kambanis, let's look at ISIS right now. I mean, as we know, Syria is a complex and difficult, ugly fight. The Islamic State controls Raqqa, Syria, and a few other areas. Does this strike inadvertently bolster ISIS? Are ISIS members clinking their green tea glasses this morning in a kind of celebration?
Well, the argument that the Assad regime and the Russians have made is that this strike severely curtails the Syrian government's ability to fight ISIS. I think that would be more compelling if we believed that Russia or Syria had really been doing its best to fight ISIS. For now, the most meaningful campaign against ISIS is the Iraqi and U.S. led push from the east and the U.S. led air coalition over northern Syria. I think what we will see if there are more strikes than this is the risks that come with weakening an already fragmented Syrian regime. So no matter how much you dislike the Syrian regime, as it fragments, what comes in to fill its place won't necessarily be ISIS, although it might, but it also could be other jihadist groups or other al-Qaeda-type affiliates that have come to predominate the Syrian insurgency. And this sort of leads to a bigger caveat that maybe you're going to get to, which is for all the would-be interventionists, and I mean, I'm someone who's wanted to see the U.S. do more in Syria, we have to be realistic about how limited the impact can be. No American intervention is going to magically replace Bashar al-Assad, even with a better dictator, much less with something remotely democratic. And nobody is talking about the kind of military intervention that would actually decisively turn the conflict. So at a maximum, we're talking about something that's going to make the cost for Bashar al-Assad and his supporters higher to do what they're doing, but it's not actually going to fundamentally change their bigger calculus about winning the war.
It comes with significant risks, intervention in the U.S., in the Middle East, by the U.S. with this strike. Stay with us. There's more to come. We want to hear from you. President Trump called the attack part of the vital national security interest of America. Do you think it is? Will this change anything on the ground, or was this just a symbolic one-off attack? What's been achieved? What happens next? Stay with us on Forum and join the conversation at 866-733-6786. Join the conversation, 866-733-6786. Thanasis Kambanis, stay with us. Marcus Weisgerber, stay with us. It's Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Eric Westervelt, sitting in for Mina Kim. We're talking this hour about President Trump ordering a missile strike on Syria last night in response to an apparent Syrian government chemical weapons attack that left over 80 civilians dead. Give us a call. Join the conversation at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. We're going to get to your calls in a moment. You can also email your questions to forum at kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. We're speaking with Marcus Weisgerber, global business editor at Defense One, Thanasis Kambanis, a senior fellow at the Century Foundation. And we're joined now by Aaron David Miller, vice president for new initiatives, and a distinguished scholar, Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Thank you all for joining us. And Aaron David Miller, first coming back to you, Assad was winning this conflict, essentially. Hezbollah and Iran helped, and Russia helped, you know, sort of get him out of a jam. Talk about the grim logic, if there is any, of why he might use chemical weapons at this point in this conflict against civilians.
I mean, the use of nerve agents, in this case, maybe sarin, is, you know, whether it was unprecedented or not, but the pattern of Assad's behavior, particularly now that he has managed to secure control over Syria's major cities, got the UN vote in the Security Council. I mean, you could even argue that he has the illusion that he's actually reconstituting the country. He's got the Iranians and the Russians to back him. And the Russians clearly were aware, since this was a chemical weapons depot at the Syrian base that the U.S. struck, that he's using these agents. I think there's a sense of unity, a sense that the international community is divided, self-interested, it lacks the capacity or will to thwart him. And he clearly saw in the campaign rhetoric of the current president and in some of his statements after he became president that he was going to leave Assad to his own devices. In fact, cooperating with the Russians and basically accepting the reality, yeah, Assad may be part of the problem, but I think the Trump administration come to the conclusion that Assad was part of the solution. So miscalculation for sure. But remember, this is a long movie. And 59 TLAMs launched against the Syrian military base is only the beginning of a very complicated dance that is going to have to find a way to find the right balance between Mr. Trump's risk aversion and his risk readiness, apparently now. Whether he can find that balance, what this actually means, I don't think the administration has a clear idea, frankly, of what kind of strategy, at least as of now, it wants to apply to Syria.
That's an important point, Aaron David Miller, and then to you, Thanasis Kambanis. Do you sense that this is part of a larger strategy or something cooked up rather quickly, purely in reaction to this chemical weapons attack?
My impression is that that there is no long-term strategy, that the hope of the Trump administration was that Syria was about to go away, that with Assad regime's winning and Turkey having sort of withdrawn from active a role in supporting the insurgency, that Syria would just settle down. And in fact, in the region, we were starting to hear more and more conversations about what's next for Israel and Hezbollah and Israel's concerns about Bashar's Syria once the war was over. So I had this feeling a little cart ahead of the horse from the Western policy establishment that, you know, reconstruction was on the table, who's going to pay for it, and all the rest of it. Suddenly, this sort of bizarrely gratuitous and almost impossible to understand crime, war crime, gets committed by the Assad regime. And I suspect that Trump was probably shocked. I think he probably expected better treatment from the Syrians and the Russians, frankly, and the Iranians after he gave them so much of what they wanted, including allowing the Iran nuclear deal to stand, despite his criticism of it. So I suspect, in a bit of a fit of sort of outrage, that he asked for a quick response, and the response that was put on the table was very similar, from reports we hear, to the response that Obama considered himself in the infamous non-strike event of August in September 2013.
Let's take some more calls. Our folks have been waiting patiently. Joan in San Jose, welcome to Forum.
Hi. I heard on NPR previously that the organization, the United Nations Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, if there is such a thing, I'd like to know, says that the U.S. and Russia both have the largest chemical weapons arsenals in the world. And I also wanted to know if the International Convention on Use of Chemical Weapons allows storing of chemical weapons as long as they are not used. Now, we know Russia did use polonium to get rid of a few news people who they didn't like. And Ellen Wilson wrote a book on the plutonium files where the United States used uranium and thorium injections and plutonium injections in public health clinics to experiment and see what would happen, for example, on pregnant women and insane asylums, et cetera. I wanted to know whether or not limited use on your own citizens as an experiment is permitted.
Aaron David Miller talk about the U.S. and Russia and their stockpiles of chemical weapons in their
arsenal? I think storage is probably committed or acquiesced in, unless as was the case in the U.S.-Russian agreement through the Organization for Prevention of Use of Chemical Weapons in the U.N., that agreement stipulates that in this particular case, that the Syrians would be rid of these agents. Mm. And large masses, some as high as 90% people say, of Assad's chemical weapons were destroyed and or transported out of the country. But that clearly there are residual stockpiles and maybe even production facilities. Mm. So, no, I think use is clearly prohibited, and that's one of the reasons. And if you look at President Trump's statement last night, you see that he described, I think, as a vital national interest, prohibition and prevention of use of these materials. So he's drawing the line, at least now, very narrowly in terms of what this was all about.
Damien in San Bruno, welcome to Forum. Thanks for waiting.
Well, thank you. I just want to say it's very disheartening, this whole thing, because, one, I don't believe Assad did it. Two, no one really looked at the fact that there was a warehouse by al-Nusra Front, an al-Qaeda operative in Syria, that had and had used gas against innocent civilians. Three, it wasn't a military target, the village. And four, what really bothers me is this continuous narrative over the six-year war that is so anti-Russian, anti-Iran, and anti-Assad that it is impossible for the Western media to be objective and view it from both sides. And they don't even question it. And so this just seems to me very disheartening, because there was a possibility of resolution. And now that the United States is getting involved, Russia and Iran have two choices, either harden their attitude or withdraw. And more likely than not, they'll harden their attitude. Thank you.
Marcus Weiss-Gerber, Global Business Editor for Defense One. Do you want to take part of that? I mean, President Trump last night pointed the finger at the Obama administration on the chemical weapons issue, saying their decision not to take action, you know, when Assad used chemical weapons apparently on civilians in 2013, led to this moment that sarin attack crossed a red line drawn by President Obama, but nothing happened. Does President Trump have a point?
Well, there's one thing we certainly did find out was that, as we know from the numerous Bob Woodward books that have been written about the decision making, that process that Obama went through, these long and intensive months of meetings and reports before making a decision on whether to use military action. We know Donald Trump hasn't even been in the White House for 3 months, and he appears ready, and he has demonstrated he is ready to use military action and make decisions much quicker than President Obama did.
Aaron David Miller, to you, people are talking this morning about the message it sends to Iran, North Korea, and China. And we should point out that President Trump is holding meetings with Chinese President Xi Jinping. Talk about the wider diplomatic implications, Aaron David Miller.
Well, I think the frame of reference is clear. I mean, you know, you now have in a single frame, which is very intriguing, in fact, that you've got the president of China, a patron of one of the three outliers that are in that frame, North Korea, Syria, and Iran, all in some respects as recipients of this message. And the message presumably is, I'm a new president, forget the old one, I'm risk ready, I believe in America first, but I'm prepared to use, project American power in select cases, and you all better watch out. Now, in the case of Iran, there's an immediate issue, and that is to say, if in fact this turns into a proxy war, and the administration's position on Syria goes well beyond just chemical weapons and starts to talk about realigning a new political reality, forcing Mr. Assad out, you're going to end up with an Iranian-U.S. Confrontation, probably through proxies, but maybe even directly in Syria. For the North Koreans, you know, the message is in some respects the same, but if it's just confined to chemical weapons, and this becomes a kind of one-off departure. I don't think it'll have much of a resonance at all on what Kim Jong-un is thinking. If, however, it becomes a matter of regime change, that's where the administration goes, then I think Kim Jong-un's tenaciousness to keep his nukes is going to grow intensely, because he'll see the message of regime change as one that is directed against him, and the only thing that would prevent it, in his case, I'm sure he argues, is possession of nuclear weapons.
Potential message of regime change. We're getting a lot of questions on Facebook and Twitter. Amina asks, wasn't the U.S. already bombing in Syria? Why is this really different? Is it because it targeted Assad instead of ISIS? The NASA's commanders talk about that a little bit. The U.S. is already involved, with special operations at least, in the fight against ISIS.
Right. So we've had a U.S. military intervention in Syria going for almost as long as there's been a war, including a covert train and equip for rebels, a lot of bombing since the ISIS campaign took place. And your questioner has it right. The big difference here is this is the first time that intentionally the United States or openly has struck the regime. There was an incident, by the way, in the fall where the United States-led anti-ISIS coalition bombed a Syrian government military position in the east, and they claimed that was an accident. Why this upsets people so much or alarms people so much, I think there's two reasons. One is because it really does raise at least the prospect of an outright full war against Assad and all those implications that Aaron just mentioned. And two, because it is, in my view, in a good way, a reestablishment of the fact that there are boundaries to what this awful humanity crushing coalition around Assad has done over the course of this war, which is, make civilians the primary target of a mass murder campaign, half a million people dead in 5 or 6 years of war, almost all of them killed by the regime. The amount of people killed by ISIS and Al-Qaeda combined is like one-tenth of what the regime kills. And this is, depending on your perspective, I mean, some of your callers might think that's great and unobjectionable, but from this region's neighborhood, even people who are sympathetic to the Assad regime or to Iran or to Hezbollah find this level of mass violence destabilizing and alarming. And some line being drawn around it is significant, whether you oppose or support that. It's a real difference.
Thanasis Kambanis, he's a fellow at the Century Foundation, author of Once Upon a Revolution about Egypt's revolution. Thanasis, thanks so much for joining us from Beirut today. I appreciate it.
Great talking to you, man. Thanks for having me on the show.
We're talking about Syria, America, and the Middle East. Still with us, Aaron David Miller and Marcus Weisgerber. We're going to go to more calls right now. Let's talk to Alex in San Francisco. You're on the air.
Hi. You mentioned earlier that President Trump said that his attack was vital for national security interests of the United States. What is it that he means when he says that?
Marcus Weisgerber, you want to take that one. What do we know about what President Trump means by vital national security interest? What are you hearing at the Pentagon?
Well, we know that the Syrian forces don't really pose a threat to U.S. forces. I mean, in Syria, there are, as you mentioned earlier, there are U.S. special operations forces there, but they really haven't been messed with, for lack of a better term, by Assad's forces. The real national security interest for the United States, now I'm speaking specifically to the homeland here, is more ISIS. ISIS, in their ideology, has been known to inspire attacks all over the world. Mm-hmm. Now, in the region, Assad has been known to threaten his neighbors, who are U.S. allies. So the U.S. typically will stand in line with its allies.
Let's go to Michael in Oakland. You are on the air with Forum. What's your question? Comment.
Hi. More of a comment than a question. I have to say this is the first time I've really been able to unambiguously support this president.
We seem to have lost him there, but we will try to get you back. We're getting a lot of comments. A listener writes in on Facebook, what a purity of gut feeling. President Trump heard and saw the atrocity and used his goodness to act. I commend him for taking this small step. It's truly in the U.S. national security interest to say that you cannot gas humanity. And quote, Aaron David Miller, some folks are writing in saying they're glad that the president acted decisively where President Obama did not.
You know, it's funny. It's a personal issue for me because I, by and large, during the Obama administration, from outside, I did very, very wary of precisely the sort of train of events that we're now seeing, that a one-off strike would lead to any administration to a new put-up-or-shut-up moment, that somehow the Russians, the Iranians, and perhaps the regime would test the United States again. What happens, for example, when the Assad regime decides tomorrow or the next day to intensify their campaign against insurgents, Islamists, the rebels, and uses conventional means, barrel bombs, and kills, hits a hospital, kills 40 or 50 women and children, civilians, innocents. What does the United States do then? Mm-hmm. Well, I think you begin to see the problems involved in the use of military force, where, in effect, you don't have a set of sustainable goals that you can achieve. I'm not worried about another Iraq and Afghanistan, and I do see the moral clarity and the importance of at least imposing a certain measure of accountability, regardless of what happens in the future, in the face of such a horrific, horrendous act. But you've got, 400,000 dead Syrians, and even if 30% of those are regime deaths, and we're functions of a civil war, and the largest single refugee flow since the end of the Second World War, you have a mess in Syria. And this action is not going to address this mess, and it's more than likely going to draw the United States deeper and deeper into the muck and mire of what is required to put both the Iraqi and Syrian Humpty Dumpties back together again. And that is a fraught enterprise, particularly for a president who, until 2 days ago, seemed to be incredibly risk-averse with respect to getting involved in that muck and mire. But this was necessary, in my judgment, and it was proportionate.
It is a quick turnaround, and to that point, a listener writes in, will these strikes increase the likelihood for more U.S. military action? Another asks, what will the larger Russian reaction be? Marcus Weisberger, business editor at Defense One, the Russians have already said they're pulling out of this defense agreement with the U.S. Is this just temporary? What can you tell us about that? That seems important.
Well, actually, as we've been on the air, I'm seeing some action on Twitter, if you will. A political reporter tweeting, senior U.S. military official says the memorandum of understanding with Russia is still in effect, and there have been conversations with the Russians since the strike. One thing to remember here is this hotline, if you will, is not, as we mentioned earlier in the show, it's not between Washington and Moscow at senior levels. These are operations center officers who are in the Middle East talking back and forth with each other. Mm-hmm. And primarily what they've done thus far is that they've communicated where they're going to be striking ISIS and where their aircraft are. Namely, so there's not this miscalculation of being hostile, and that somebody doesn't get shot down, and then in turn escalates the current campaign against ISIS, and turns it into a war, say, between the U.S. and Russia.
So this is potentially dangerous. It ends this deconfliction protocol that's been going on for quite a while now. Yes.
It does, but it's also important to remember when this started, when Russia moved forces and air jets and surface to air missiles, some of the most advanced surface to air missiles that are known to exist into Syria, there wasn't this type of communication. But like everything with Russia, there are troughs, if you will, in the relations between the military. Mm-hmm. What you'll tend to see is a separation between what the political leaders are saying, and you'll see the military leaders. You'll probably see the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Dunford, at some point reach out to his counterpart in Russia to have some sort of discussion. But again, conflicting reports. Russia says they've stopped. U.S. says, hey, we're still talking.
We're talking about America, Syria, and the Middle East. Tom in Oakland, you're on the air. What's your question or comment?
Hi, I'm probably one of the 80% anti-Trump voters out there who support this action that's long overdue. And to the last caller's question, what is the national security issue? I'm thinking about the 1925 Geneva's protocol prohibiting the use of chemical and bio weapons against civilians, and also the 1949 Geneva's Convention targeting hospitals and centers of refuge and civilians. And these are critical elements that need to be saved that does impact the security of not just Americans, but global citizens, because they were created to prevent the downward slide, slippery slope of unfettered warfare. Now, there are risks in this action. If Trump doesn't follow this up with a call to open direct negotiations with Russia over the nuclear weapons stockpile, 10,000 weapons strong, which are nothing but a civilian destroying genocidal
weapon. Valid question, Tom. Thanks for your call. Aaron David Miller, take that up, looking at the Geneva Protocol. And we also get a question in from Susan. Has President Trump violated the War Powers Act? Talk a little bit about his power to take these actions and to go to war.
Well, yeah, the AUMF, the Authorization Use of Force Memorandum that is now in train and outdated in the wake of 9/11, is the authorizing authority, at least here, presumably constitutionally, for any number of actions, including everything that we've done against ISIS, everything we've done in Syria and Iraq, and what the administration's doing now. I don't believe that a new negotiating with Congress of a new AUMF is realistic. I think the Trump administration won't want it because that will force them to lay out their strategy comprehensively.
Aaron David Miller, your line's breaking up a little bit. We're going to go to a caller, William in Belvedere. You are on the air. What's your question or comment for our panelists?
Thank you. I'll be brief. I was in the New York Times says that the cancellation of this agreement between Russia and the United States to avoid planes coming into conflict it doesn't exist at this point anymore because of that. And I don't, just because something said on Twitter that isn't true, I don't understand why the guest puts what the New York Times says and quoting people on an equal par with something that's on Twitter. So I see a real danger.
It's a fair point. Juan also writes in, we need to stay out of there. We're not even sure where this gas came from. Another listener writes in, there is nothing decent, honorable, or presidential about bombing an airfield. Welcoming refugees to America's shores is presidential. Aaron David Miller is back with us. In the few minutes we have left, talk about where you think we go from here. We know this may be just a one-off, but we're not sure. Does this change policy in the Middle East for the Trump administration when you're looking at a larger strategy, not just dealing with Syria, but also Israel, the stalled peace process there, some might say the dead peace process? Talk a little bit about the larger implications throughout the region.
I mean, I think it's way too early to look at this as some sort of transformative action. I don't believe that this president is looking at foreign policy as a kind of transformation. It's a transaction, basically. Mm-hmm. Right now, I think we could be confident that what is intended is a relatively limited transaction using force in an effort to try to get the Syrians to understand that if they use CW again, there will be an even greater response, and the Russians, their key patron, to some extent the Iranians, to get them to understand that they have a role to play. I do not believe this is somehow the beginning of a concerted and conscious U.S. policy on the part of this administration to basically, in the end, get stuck with a check for Syria by embarking on a huge investment and a strategy to solve the day after rather than the decade after problem. What happens if you do in fact force Assad out? I do not believe that's what has occurred. But let's be clear: the glass, whatever it is, the glass ceiling, the constraints have been broken now. Mm. 7 years of constraints have now been broken, and the U.S. has used military force. And chances are, I would predict, we'll end up using it against Assad again.
We've got time for one more call. Bill in San Jose, you're on the air. Welcome to Forum. Oh, Bill, we've lost Bill. I'm seeing an alert from the Associated Press that the Pentagon is looking into whether Russia participated in this chemical attack. Marcus Weisgerber, are you hearing anything at the Pentagon about that issue, investigating Russia participation or acquiescence in this chemical attack?
Well, as we've been talking, there has been actually a briefing going on at the Pentagon. These briefings, like the ones we had last night, have not been televised, so you've actually had to physically be there. So I've been on the air here, but what I can tell you is I did just get from the Pentagon. They've just sent out aerial shots. I can't tell if they're from satellite, and it's depicting impact strikes for the impact mark craters from those Tomahawks last night. They're showing destroyed aircraft shelters and damaged aircraft shelters, but they also do show as they claimed last night when we were there in the building, that the runway, the main runway there, which is supposedly used by the Russians as well, it is intact. And these photos again are from the Pentagon, and they're dated today. So they had told us last night they were going to wait for satellites to pass over once daylight came to do the battle damage assessment, which does continue right now.
There'll be much more on this throughout the day on KQED and NPR News. Thanks so much to Marcus Weiss-Gerber, Global Business Editor, Defense One. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
And Aaron David Miller, Vice President for New Initiatives and a distinguished scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We heard earlier from Thanasis Kambanis. He's a fellow at the Century Foundation. And we also had the BBC's editor for Arab Affairs, Sebastian Usher. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lorberg, Susan Britton, Jeremy Siegel, and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Katie McMurrin. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. We get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Stephanie Roberts and Devin Holt. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Holly Kernan. I'm Eric Westervelt, sitting in for Mina Kim. Thanks so much for listening and joining the conversation on Forum this morning.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.